the police gave us some report, some form, that said that someone had gone out and looked at the Jeep and that it was fine and showed no signs of damage. It was dated the day after the accident, but no one thinks that's when they actually went over and looked at it. Again, this is a small town. Todd's father was the mayor. He said his son was home all night, so his son was home all night. The Jeep vanishes, the Jeep reappears a week later, and the police say the Jeep is fine. So the Jeep was fine.
Did anyone keep the bike? Stevie asked. They could check for paint.
I think about this all the time,
Paul said, shaking his head.
This was 1978. No one knew to ask about things like that. Years later, I went back and asked about the bike, but there's no record of what happened to it. It's gone. I assume they got rid of it. I mean, it was a hit and run in a small town. It was sad, but not a lot could be done about it. That was the general attitude.
So if everyone knew it was Todd, what happened?
Well, there were basically three camps in town. There were people who thought Todd did it and supported us. There were some people who thought Todd was innocent. Not many, but a few. Those people make me furious, but not as furious as the third group, which I think was the biggest group of all. The people who knew Todd did it and chose to do nothing. They knew Dana saw him. They knew the car was missing for a week. They knew it all, but they thought it was just an accident. Why ruin a kid's life over an accident? They knew the mayor was lying, but they put it down to protecting his kid. Being a good dad. Those are the people I could never forgive.
He had to pause for a moment and shift in his seat. Stevie could see the weight he still felt all these years later.
I had to go back to school with the guy I knew had run my brother down and gotten away with it,
he said.
I had to see him every day. I avoided him, and he avoided me. I was also dealing with the fact that I was a gay, closeted jock in the late 1970s, so I was trying to compensate and seem really whatever straight and manly looked like then. It wasn't an easy time, but we got through it. My parents were amazing people. My dad wanted justice, fairness. He didn't want revenge. He wasn't that kind of person. He wanted people to do the right thing. He never stopped trying to get someone to look into it. When the local police let him down, he tried the state police. When the state police couldn't help, he went to the local press. He talked to everyone who would listen. He would have kept going, but 7 months later, Todd was dead.
He lifted his hands gently as if to say, "And that was that." "You were at the camp that night," Stevie said. "The night of the murders."
I was, like every other teenager in town. Everyone knew that group was going out that night. It was an open secret when Eric was going to get the weed. Back then, it was both illegal and everywhere. I bought off him, everyone did. Every week he would come around and ask you what you wanted, and you'd give him a few bucks, and he went somewhere and picked up the stash.
"Who would have known where that was?" Stevie asked.
Everyone knew it was in the woods somewhere. The whole thing was kind of an open secret. The only part Eric really kept quiet was the exact spot it was hidden, to make sure it wasn't stolen. I mean, he took Sabrina out there, and she wasn't really in that group of people for very long. It was, in all other respects, a totally normal night. There were three lifeguards, Todd, Greg Dempsey, and Sean Greenvale. Todd was out in the woods. Greg was on house arrest in one of the camp admin offices, so I went over to the lake house to hang out with Sean. I would never have gone in with Todd there, or Greg, really. Sean was learning guitar, and he was trying to learn how to play Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, just like every other kid in the 70s. Susan checked on us, then I went back to my bunk. I think I read a book or something for a while, then I went to sleep. I remember waking up to someone screaming the next morning. That's really all I know. Obviously, people looked at my family because of what happened to Michael. But we got lucky in one respect. Our neighbors were over at our house all the time after Michael died, bringing us food, generally taking care of us and keeping us company. On the night of the murders, our neighbors, Mr. and Mrs. Atkins, were over for dinner and stayed to watch television. My mom took medication every night to help her sleep, and she went to bed around 9:30. Mrs. Atkins went home, but Mr. Atkins stayed until 2 in the morning, having beers with my dad on the porch and playing cards. At least that left my parents out of it. And I was with Sean up until the time I went to bed. The other counselor saw me come in. So we were spared that, mostly. People still looked at us funny sometimes, but everyone knew we had nothing to do with it.
What do you think happened? She asked.
It was so chaotic, he said. The police were in way over their heads. Everything was botched from the jump. First they said it was something to do with drugs, but no one was going to murder 4 people over a bag of grass at a summer camp. And then on top of it all, leave the grass there. So then they started talking about the serial killer. That was the big angle, and I guess most people thought that must have been what happened. But that's fallen apart with time as well. So what do I think?
He looked up and around at his town for a moment.
There was too much wrong in our town, he said. I knew it. I'd experienced it. I don't believe in curses. I'm not superstitious or anything like that. I just mean that ours was the kind of town where bad things could happen and everything could remain under the surface. Something about it always felt personal, local. Something about finding that spot in the woods, being there at the right time. Something about the timing of it all.
He crumpled his empty coffee cup.
Hope that helps, he said. Honestly, I think too much time has passed. I don't think we'll ever know. Good luck anyway. I hope you get to enjoy camp, at least.
He smiled and left Stevie alone with her thoughts, sitting in the shadow of John Barlow and his horse. 17. As Stevie left town and headed back to the camp, she had a thought. She swerved and looped down one of the side streets. It maybe was tempting fate to visit the spot where someone had been struck down on a bicycle, especially when you were uncertain about your skills on said bicycle. But Stevie had never been one to take the prudent course. She looked up directions to the site on her phone. It was a nondescript corner, a 4-way stop lined with low suburban houses. There were no sidewalks here, just lawn all the way up to the street. It was placid and tree-lined, and there was nothing to mark the spot where Michael Penhale had fallen on that December night. But it was easy to see how such an accident could have happened. At night, it would be dark here. There were no streetlights now that she could see, which meant there were probably none then either. A car barreling along, not stopping or clipping the edge. She leaned on the handlebars, looking carefully at the traffic around her. As she rode back, she came up on the sharp curve that turned down the road toward the local high school. This was where Patty said Greg Dempsey had crashed his motorcycle in the week after the accident. It was easy to see how he had done it. The turn was sharp, heavily bordered by a wall of trees and rock. If you didn't make it, you'd go right into it, as he had done. It was a death turn. It certainly seemed like others had made the same mistake, because there were remnants of old memorials, a decrepit cross, half buried by tall grass, and a teddy bear coming apart from age and exposure. Stevie looked down the length of the road and saw the comically large Liberty High sign. There was something eerie about being out here alone, even though it was just a roadside on a bright summer's day. A lot of bad things happened in this town in a short time between December 1977 and July 1978. 7 months or so of tragedy. It was grim. She stuck very close to the grass edge of the road as she cycled back toward the town center, more than once getting off the bike and wheeling it by her side, out of nervousness of someone coming along the road and striking her from behind. By the time she got back, Camp Sunny Pines had changed. The children had arrived. They came in cars and buses, in ones and twos. They came with their shiny backpacks and their scooter helmets. They came, screaming their high-pitched screams over the peace of the lake. Obviously, this was no surprise. But still, the landscape was so totally altered by their presence that Stevie was confused. She had started to know this place, its long stretches of field that always smelled of fresh-cut grass, the little brown buildings, the outdoor pipes, the signs. It had been hers first, then shared with a few people her age, but now the children were everywhere. It suddenly occurred to her what she had actually signed up for. She wandered past as parents slowly detached crying children from their legs or watched as happy children ran off, unaware that their parents were still there. Janelle and Nate were two of the last counselors left in the dining area. Breakfast was largely closed up and over, but Stevie managed to convince the woman behind the counter to peel back the plastic wrap and let her have some cold pancakes. She didn't even need silverware or a plate. She put them in a napkin and ate them by hand, dry. She snagged a cup of the substance that passed as orange juice and sat down with her friends. As soon as she did so, she felt a presence at her back. Nicole sat down on the bench next to her. "You in town this morning?" Stevie sipped some acidic orange juice-like drink and hmmed. "I know you have special permission from Carson, but the kids are here now." "I know," Stevie said, because she did know. She could see the children, who were being rounded up by some of the counselors and led off to their bunks in the distance. "So that means you have a job to do." "I am," Stevie said. "It took longer to get back from town." "I'm just saying," Nicole said, then said no more and got up and walked away.
"She likes you," Nate said.
"Don't worry about it," Janelle added. "I have it all covered." She produced a binder, inside of which were a series of color-coded spreadsheets, each tagged with sticky notes. "I've got all the crafts set up by age," she said. "Now let's see." And that morning and afternoon, Stevie did see. They made samples of everything on Janelle's chart while attending multiple assemblies where names were learned and rules were read and everyone was welcomed. The kids were, Stevie had to admit, fairly cute. At least most of them were. The oldest ones were 11, and they clearly viewed the counselors not quite as equals, but certainly as peers of a sort. Stevie kept glancing at her phone, checking for updates, and the one she was waiting for finally came around 4.
"I'm here,"
David wrote. "See you later," Janelle said, smiling. Even though Stevie had just been told not to leave, nothing was going to keep her away. She slipped away from one of the sessions, ducking between the cabins and hurrying across the fields, right on to the camp entrance, running over the road that split the camp from the park. She hustled down the paths until she reached the place where she could see the parking lot. There, standing by an old gray Nissan, was David. David and Stevie had last been together at school every day in December. Fate and a bunch of murders and a senator had separated them. There had been lots of video and endless pics, so they were constantly in each other's lives. But she had not seen him in the flesh since that cold, snowy morning up on the mountain in Vermont when they had come to take him away. She knew every element of his face from every angle a camera screen and her memory had captured. But seeing him here, fully assembled, scrambled her brain for a second. Had he always been that tall, that wiry, with tight coils of muscle? Was the shirt big or was he thinner? Had those always been his legs? And his hair, dark loose curls that had grown ragged and free at Ellingham, were clipped a bit shorter now. She had known that, had seen the images, but now nothing quite fit. But her body knew what to do. She ran up to him, jumping, and he caught her clumsily. They fell back against the car door, and she kissed him through his smile. Yes, it all made sense again. The picture reassembled itself, the feel of her face in the hollow of his neck, the way his arms wrapped around her back and they curved into one another, his breath, his heartbeat. David. Also, she was on her toes and they were both sliding sideways down the side of the car and they stumbled apart, laughing.
"Have we met?" he said.
She squeezed him around the middle.
"Want to help me set up?" he said. "It would be good to have a place to sleep before the sun goes down."
Stevie and David removed a bunch of equipment from the back of the car. A tent, a cooler, a camp stove, two folding chairs, and a small folding table. They walked this to an empty area close to the lake edge.
The sleeping bag is mine, he said. I use that in some of the shadier places we stay in on the road. The rest of the stuff I rented from a place in town. I even rented a kayak from their boathouse. Now, how does one tent?
The tent proved to be more challenging than it first appeared. There was a lot of staking things into the ground, and rolling in the right way, and inserting tubes in pockets and attaching. But somewhere around the 2-hour mark, Stevie and David entered the tent, found it to be stable, and immediately tried out the floor. This was so private. It was unlike anything Stevie had ever experienced. Even in their rooms at Ellingham, this was wild and separate, and they had come together here for a reason. David had come a long way to be with her. Her. That was the only reason he was here.
I need to go soon, she said. Do you have to go back?
She considered for a long minute. The temptation to stay exactly where she was, on this sleeping bag, in this tent, was tremendous. On the other hand, Nicole had been unambiguous when it came to things like skipping out for the night.
I have to go, she said. I'll walk you over, he said. These are murder woods, right?
But then you'll be walking back alone. These are murder woods.
Good point. Stay.
Stop, she said, pushing him and not wanting him to stop at all. There immediately followed a round of making out, which ended only when Janelle called Stevie and told her that Nicole had been around and curfew was falling fast.
Really have to go, Stevie said. Quick, go. Then I'll drive you, he said.
It was convenient to have a car here now. Stevie scrambled to make herself presentable again, still pulling on her socks and shoes as they left the tent. David drove her out of the park's parking lot and down the short stretch of road to the opening of the camp. He drove her almost the full way down the driveway, stopping before the entrance sign and the lights. Stevie hopped out into the warm night, waving and watching all the way, and ran to the cabin. When Nicole checked again, Stevie was on her bed, looking at her tablet like she had never been gone. 18.
Good morning, Sunny Pines.
Stevie blinked into her pillow and turned her head to look at Janelle. Janelle was not there. When Stevie gathered up her things and stepped outside to take her shower, she found a long line of children waiting to get into the bathroom. Janelle stood somewhere in the middle.
This is bad, she said out loud.
The line was so long that Stevie ended up skipping the shower entirely and heading to breakfast with Janelle. Nate was already there waiting for them. He picked up a tray and stepped into line between them, then followed them to a table.
How was the first night? Janelle asked.
Do you see the kid with the red hair?
He replied.
Blue shirt? His name is Lucas. He is my nemesis.
You can't have an 8-year-old nemesis, Janelle said, picking the grapes out of her fruit cup.
Don't tell me how to live my life. Oh God, he's coming over here.
Lucas, the nemesis, had noticed Nate and was indeed walking toward them, eating a sausage link with his fingers as he did so. He sat down at the table with them without asking permission and looked at Janelle and Stevie.
Are you his friends? He asked.
Lucas was direct.
Yes, Janelle said sweetly. We go to school together.
I've read his book 7 times, he said.
Wow, Janelle replied. That's a lot.
Because it was a lot, and this kid was 8 years old.
Yeah, Lucas replied. I'm still waiting for the next one. He says he's not done.
Nate's head shrank a bit into his shoulders, like a slowly descending elevator.
Can you get him to finish it? Lucas asked.
I don't think so, Janelle replied, but he will.
I have ideas, Lucas went on.
I wrote it,
Nate said as Lucas wandered back to his bunk's table.
I don't need ideas.
You kind of do, Janelle said under her breath.
I'm in hell.
He's 8, Janelle pointed out again, and he read your book. That's nice. Nate physically recoiled.
You'll have more time soon, Janelle went on. It's just another day or so until the other counselor gets here.
If Stevie thought that the morning had been an abrupt swing into action, she had no idea what the day had in store. The minute that the trays were cleared from the picnic tables, the entire camp moved over to the green, where they assembled in a ring around the flagpole, said the Pledge of Allegiance, and listened to some announcements. Then all the groups split off and activities began. It was a good thing that Janelle was the way she was. The art pavilion was ready. In fact, it was likely that in the entire history of the camp, the art pavilion had never been as ready as it was on that morning. Janelle had waited her whole life for this moment, and now it was upon her. These children had no idea what they were in for. They would craft like they had never crafted in their lives. For a few hours, there was no case. There was no David. There were pipe cleaners and markers and rounded scissors. Stevie had glue stuck on her fingertips and paint on her arms and had helped make half a dozen flapping owls out of paper plates, several beaded necklaces, some kind of thing with paint and feet. During the short periods that the pavilion was free of kids, Janelle was sweeping around, an ecstatic glow on her face, as she was combining her loves of crafting, organizing, and cleaning into one geode of pleasure. Lunch came and went, then the entire afternoon. Soon there was dinner, during which Nate hid behind one of the dining pavilion pillars before vanishing entirely, and then the first day was over.
I'm going to get set up for tomorrow and talk to Vi, Janelle said. Meet you back in the cabin.
Stevie called David on the way back.
Finally, he said. I wondered where you were.
There are so many. She looked around nervously.
Little kids. At a summer camp? Holy shit, we need to tell someone about this.
Also, Stevie said, I have to make sure the head of camp doesn't notice I'm gone. It may be harder now that kids are here. Kids see things, right?
How about I come there? I can kayak over. I was out paddling around on that side of the lake earlier, and there's a stream deep enough to ride over on. It'll only take a few minutes.
This was a good plan. It took a long time to go around the lake, but going over the lake was quick and easy, and there were plenty of places to dock the kayak or whatever it was you did with them. Stevie had a vague sense that maybe this was not allowed, but a vague sense is not a clear, definite sense. A purple twilight fell over the lake as Stevie sat alone on the far side of the lake house. She could hear kids singing in the distance, and fireflies floated and twinkled all around her. There was a magical quality to the night already when David came gliding along the dark waters in a yellow plastic kayak, beaching it, maybe that was the verb, next to her on the rocky sand.
Pretty good entrance, he said, right?
Stevie could see at once that he had made an extra effort that night. His hair was tousled, but in a very artful way. He wore a fitted black t-shirt that she had never seen before, and she was immediately certain that he'd bought it just because it fit him in exactly the right ways. He was wearing long swim trunks and flip-flops, but even these seemed to be part of an ensemble. He bent down and whispered low in her ear,
"Do you live around here?"
Stevie actually shivered. Her body went loose, like the screws all fell out at once. She grabbed his hand and took him around behind the bunks, weaving out of the way of any lights or people, until they reached her cabin. For one extremely fleeting second, she thought about Sabrina and the others slipping into the woods way back when, the thrill of getting away with something at this dark, warm place alongside the lake. She felt herself understand something about them. And the understanding was deep and profound, and also gone a few seconds later. They had reached the cabin and shut the door. In the next minute, they were on the camp bed. The next thing she knew, there was a firm pounding on the door, and her eyes ached from the light when she opened them. She sprang up, straightening out her clothes. There was nowhere to hide David. The cabin had no closets, so she had no choice but to open the door and take whatever was coming. Nicole stood on the step looking grim. She glanced inside and sighed deeply.
Who are you?
She asked David, who was sitting on the edge of the bed and maybe looking a little too amused.
I'm...
He looked at Stevie as if she held the secret to his true identity, the one he had never been able to share with the world.
David?
David who? How did you get here?
Kayak?
You need to go, now.
Nicole waited for him to get up and straighten his shirt.
I'll walk you back to your kayak, she said. You shouldn't be out on the lake after dark. Do you have a flashlight?
Stevie, give him a flashlight.
Stevie did so, and David took it with a nervous smile. The two of them were about to leave when Nicole drew her head back and looked above the door.
Is that a camera?
I'm recording birds, Stevie said. She had no idea why she said that. It's just what came out.
I'll be back in a few minutes. We need to talk.
She was back a short time later, alone. Stevie had tidied the cabin in her absence, as if the situation might improve if her shower caddy was in better order.
I want to be very clear about something, Nicole said. I know you are here as Carson's guest, but if I catch you bringing people into the camp at any time unauthorized, you will be gone, Carson or no Carson. This is a camp for children, which means we have a duty of care. I'm responsible for every single person on these grounds. No strangers around the kids, no people kayaking at night on the lake. That lake can be dangerous. This is the one and only time I am going to say this.
This was all delivered in such a tone of serious, grinding finality that Stevie was humiliated to her bone marrow.
Yep, she said. Got it. Yep.
As Nicole left, Janelle came in. Stevie could tell that Janelle had heard everything that had gone down, and she looked at Stevie wide-eyed as she shut the door.
Fun night? She asked.
Kind of got busted with David.
I know, she said, sounding maybe a little irritated. I came back before. You didn't even hear me. I shut the door and backed out. I saw Nicole coming, but she was ahead of me and I couldn't get to the door in time. I texted you, but...
Stevie looked over and saw that there were 7 texts from Janelle waiting to be read.
Sorry.
Can you ask next time or tell me? Except I don't think there will be a next time because she just handed you your ass, but you know what I mean. If it were me and Vi, I'd tell you.
Sorry, Stevie said again, and she was. It's okay.
Janelle went to her bureau and started going through her various creams and washes to get ready for the night. Her tone indicated that it wasn't entirely okay yet, but it would be. After a few minutes, she turned to Stevie.
Vietnam is far, Janelle said. We don't all have people to sneak into our cabins at night.
Stevie nodded sympathetically.
Any chance you have $2,000 I can borrow for a plane ticket? Janelle asked. I've got a punch card for a free coffee that's almost full.
Janelle let out a long sigh. Only a little while until we're back at school, Stevie said.
Now I know how Nate feels, Janelle replied. Nothing is longer than a little while.
The next morning at breakfast, Stevie averted her eyes as they passed Nicole on the way in. Nate was already there when they arrived, avoiding his bunk's table and skulking in the corner with a tray of pancakes and bacon.
I thought you'd never get here, he said, sitting down with them.
Don't you have to be over there? Janelle asked.
Lucas peered up when he saw Nate. Nate slouched over his tray.
All night, he said. All night. He talked about my book, mostly what he thought was wrong with it. And where is the second one? He knows more about that book than I do. He is a sentient internet comment.
He is 8 years old, Janelle pointed out again.
You don't understand, Nate said, shaking his head. Where is this other counselor? Why isn't he better? It was supposed to be, like, one day.
Nicole said a few days, Janelle said, belying her understanding of the night before.
I did not sign up for this.
Stevie ate bacon and watched her friends squabble. She had missed them so much when they were all apart.
Your friend is here, Nate said, kept in big bag boss.
Stevie turned to look in the direction Nate was facing.
Sure enough, Carson was speedwalking through the patch of grass bordering the dining pavilion, weaving his way through the clumps of children, heading toward their table. He looked like he was on a mission, his brow furrowed.
Oh, God, Stevie said. What does he want? Nicole's going to yell at me again for bringing weirdos to the camp, even if that one does own it.
Nate looked like he wanted an explanation about that immediately, but Carson was upon them. He squatted down at the end of their table.
I need to talk to you,
he said to Stevie in a low, breathless voice. Stevie looked at her rapidly cooling pancakes.
Could I finish? He shook his head.
No time. Podcasts sleep for no one, Nate said.
Stevie sawed into the pancake stack in a desperate attempt to get them into her mouth.
Listen, he said. Allison Abbott is dead.
19. Stevie froze, a fork full of cold pancake inches from her mouth.
What?
She asked.
Arrowhead Point, Carson said. She fell during her morning run.
Stevie felt everything slowly spin away from her. She'd just seen Allison, just gone on that morning run with her, seen that spot on Arrowhead Point, where all of Lake Wonderfalls spread out below in a glorious display.
We have to go now, Carson said.
To do what?
Nate asked. Stevie did not need an explanation. She had to go, to try to see, to understand. She set her fork and knife down automatically and grabbed her phone and bag. They were halfway across the dining area when Nicole stopped them.
What's up?
She said to Carson.
What are you doing?
I need Stevie. She's got a job here. Not today, he said.
He and Stevie continued on before Nicole could make any reply and were soon in the Tesla. A minute later, they were tearing, or at least going at a moderate speed in a more or less responsible manner in a nearly silent electric car, out of camp. They drove out of the main entrance and turned toward the public side of the lake. Up ahead, Stevie could see a police car blocking the entrance road by the ranger check-in cabin.
How did you find out? She asked numbly.
I was out doing walking meditation this morning, he said. Two police cars and an ambulance went by going toward the lake, so I ran in that direction. I tried to go in, but one of the cops stopped me on the path. I ran home and got a drone to have a look and a listen. I got some footage, but I couldn't get that close.
Stevie turned in disgust, but found she had nothing to say. The shock was still too strong, and her head was fuzzy.
They're closing off the main entrances, Carson said,
continuing past the police cars.
But we can get in through the woods.
Her phone buzzed. A text from David appeared.
Come over when you can.
David was here for 5 days, all their time for the summer. What was going to happen now? She couldn't think about it. Her head was swirling. She texted back.
Is there anything weird going on there this morning?
No, he replied. Why?
That made some sense. The lake was big, and Arrowhead Point was at the far end. David was more near the middle by Point 23. Carson slid the Tesla to a stop on the side of the road.
Here,
he said, handing her a tiny microphone.
Better audio for your phone. You go in through here and see if you can record any witnesses. I'm going to try to sneak in closer near Arrowhead Point and get video footage.
Stevie didn't actually care about what Carson was doing. She needed to get into the woods and see and hear for herself what had happened to Allison. She took the microphone and hopped out of the car, sprinting across the quiet country lane. Once she was actually in the woods, her phone lost all sense of where she was located. It put her position as either in the road or in the middle of the lake. So she picked her way through the trees until she could see the glint of the water. And then she found one of the paths that wound around the lake. She walked in the direction of Arrowhead Point, trying to keep out of sight of any police or emergency personnel that might be around. But she saw no one except a woman walking her dog, who seemed to have no idea that anything was going on. Strange how someone could die in these woods and everything would be normal and peaceful. These woods ate people up and were quiet about it. Stevie felt cold despite the heat. She pressed on in a haze, finding her way on the slatted wood bridges over the hollows and the silent wood chips,
always keeping the lake on her left-hand side, watching it out of one eye, scanning for activity. Finally, she heard the sound of people talking up ahead. She left the path and wove through the trees until she could see a small group of older women gathered on a bit of sandy beach, speaking in a huddle. From here, she could see the rise of Arrowhead Point, and maybe some people walking around on top, but not much else. She slipped out of the trees, making a bit of noise so she didn't just pop out of nowhere and scare these strangers. After fitting the microphone into the jack of her phone and tucking it as far into her pocket as she could, she tried to act like she was out taking a casual walk. "Did something happen?" she said, approaching them and squinting up at the point. "Women fell," said one of the swimmers. "From up there," she nodded toward Arrowhead Point. "She just fell? We heard a scream and she kind of tumbled off."
"Like she tripped," said another swimmer.
"Yeah, she must have tripped."
This was why you weren't supposed to let witnesses talk to one another before you spoke to them. When people all see something together and discuss it, details will start to merge. All that seemed to be known was that Allison had screamed and fallen, but the story had already become that she had tripped.
Barbara, she went back to the dock because her shorts were close to the edge and she could get her phone, and I went up to wait for the police. Our friends swam over to try to help, but
it was too late, Barbara said.
She fell onto those rocks. No one would survive that.
Was there anyone else up there? Stevie said.
You mean, did someone push her? Barbara said.
Oh, God, no, there was no one. We would have seen. We could see her clearly. There was no one up there but her. She was screaming. She must have tripped.
She must have tripped,
the woman who was not Barbara repeated sadly.
Stevie decided not to press Barbara and not Barbara any further.
They were upset, and they had conveyed what they had witnessed, a woman screaming and tumbling off a rocky point.
Not a woman. Allison Abbott, the librarian, the archivist of her sister's life, the runner, the person who had been through so much, who loved her sister so fiercely.
Stevie felt nauseous and turned back into the woods, walking the way she had come, taking big gulps of soft pine-scented air, trying to let the curtain of greens and browns and pinpoint sunlight soothe her. Screaming. Tumbling. Her brain, fueled by thousands of hours of absorbing true and fictional crime, painted the scene in vivid detail. Then the rush came. The flush of anxiety and panic, the one that made the trees loom and the ground sinister. The one that twisted the morning into something that mocked her and separated her from all that was familiar.
No,
she said out loud, stopping. She closed her eyes and practiced her breathing, in slowly, holding, releasing even slower. Breathe, exhale. She let the world wobble and fall away for a moment. When she opened her eyes again, all had not been fixed in its entirety, but things were a bit more stable. And she was going somewhere that would help. She tramped on, passing several camping areas, until she finally saw some tents she recognized, and beyond them, the red one she was looking for. She jogged up to it, then wasn't sure what to do for a moment. You can't knock on a tent. Hey, she said, her voice coming out rushed. Hey? There was a stirring within.
Stevie?
Said a sleepy voice. A shuffling. Then the zipper opened itself from the inside, and a tousled-haired David in a t-shirt and shorts peered out. He smiled, but this faded when he saw her face.
What's wrong?
Stevie sat down in one of the portable camping chairs outside the tent and stared at the ground for a moment.
Allison Abbott is dead.
Allison Abbott?
He said, ducking to get out of the tent.
Who is Allison Abbott?
Sabrina's sister, the librarian. She fell off the point at the top of the lake. Arrowhead Point.
Oh, shit, he said, rubbing at his jaw, taking this in.
He didn't know Allison or Arrowhead Point, but he knew Stevie, and he knew pain and confusion. He looked around for a moment, then opened a cooler and pulled out a can of coffee.
You want this?
He said, offering her the can.
Stevie took it.
He dragged over another folding chair and sat close to her.
You okay?
He asked. He was asking that a lot now. I don't understand, she said.
Neither do I, but I have no idea what's going on.
She had explained some of the case to him, but not every detail of what she had done here. The cool parts, of course, like busting Carson and things like that. But not what it felt like to be in Allison's house, surrounded by Sabrina's things. Not the feeling of being able to give Allison something her sister had made, however minor. David studied her face for a moment.
Someone's died, he said. Someone connected to a murder that happened here. We've been here before.
He meant back at Ellingham, when someone had died at a place that was so famous for murder. She took a sip of the coffee, which was bitter and strong. She didn't love the taste, but it had a clarifying effect, so she gulped it down.
Your kayak, she said. Can it fit two people?
Just one. They have canoes, though. They can fit up to three.
Then we need to get one.
David didn't bother changing out of his sleeping clothes. He found a pair of shoes, and they walked to the little boat rental place a bit farther in, closer to Sunny Pines, and took possession of a canoe. When they helped lift it down and push it along the sand, it seemed much larger than Stevie thought it would be. And as they got it into the water, it was far wobblier than she'd hoped. But she was focused and got herself into the bench seat and worked out how to paddle. After a few minutes of confused splashing and going in circles, they were drifting out onto the placid waters of Lake Wonderfalls and headed toward Arrowhead Point. The police were moving people away from the shoreline under the peak, and they had hung a tarp over the area where Allison had landed so that nobody could view the body. But nothing stopped them from drifting closer on the water. A few people were doing the same, watching from canoes or rafts or floating tubes. Not that there was much to see. The tarp screened off most of the action. A few police officers were on the edge of the point, examining it. Stevie watched this activity for some time in silence, as David paddled a bit to keep them as stationary as possible. One of the police officers crawled along the point, then got up and walked back to the path. Presumably, they would look for any sign of what had caused Allison to fall.
I don't get it, Stevie finally said.
I'm not sure what there is to get.
You don't understand what I saw at her house, Stevie replied.
Allison was precise. She made Janelle look disorganized. Everything exactly in the right place. Schedules followed to the minute. It was part of her coping mechanism to deal with her sister's death. She ran that path at the exact same time every day.
I went with her. She knew every bump on the ground. I stood on the point with her. She warned me about how it tapered.
It's still a steep edge. People can fall off steep edges.
No, she said firmly. It wasn't an accident.
You never think it's an accident.
It was true that there had been several accidents at Ellingham Academy that Stevie didn't think were accidents. The thing was, she'd been right about those. She was right now. Stevie watched a blue dragonfly buzz the surface of the pond. The water was still, and though covered in a thin green algae haze, it managed to reflect the sky in patches and was somehow more beautiful for what marred it. If she didn't see the police working on the rocks, she would never have believed that anything could happen here. Carson called several times, and Stevie pushed them all to voicemail. She leaned back in the canoe and tried to understand how. Somewhere between the puffy clouds above and their reflections below, Allison Abbott had ceased to exist.
20.
The rest of the day that Allison died slipped past in a strange haze. Stevie went through the motions at the art pavilion, her brain churning. By dinner, she was tired from her circular thinking. She sat, her untouched food in front of her, repeating the story to Nate and Janelle for what had to have been the 15th time.
From everything you're saying, it really sounds like she fell, Janelle said. You know, most car accidents happen on roads people know the best. People go into autopilot and feel like they don't have to pay as much attention. She could have been preoccupied.
No, Stevie said again. Something's not right.
Did anything seem off about her when you gave her the list? Janelle asked.
No, she was happy to get it.
She could tell from their expressions that, like David, they knew Stevie was quick to say that something was not an accident. They also knew better than to voice this in the state Stevie was in. She walked back to their cabin, feeling lightheaded and sleepy. She called David.
Hey, she said.
You sound weird.
Just tired, she said.
The kayak thing didn't work out so well. Do you want to walk over and I'll meet you by the path?
Stevie rubbed her face with her hand. She had so little time with David, every day counted. But she was leaden with exhaustion. Something about Allison's death had knocked her sideways.
I think I need to sleep, she said.
She heard him sigh.
Get some rest, he said. I'll see you tomorrow.
Tomorrow, she said, going up the steps to her cabin. Once she got inside, she flopped onto her bed, not even bothering to take off her shoes. It was only 7 in the evening, still light out. But Stevie was shutting down. She closed her eyes, letting the cabin and the camp and the confusion of the day slip away. Just as she was nodding off, her phone rang. It was an unknown local number.
Is this Stephanie Bell? Said a woman's voice.
Yes?
My name is Susan Marks, she said. I used to run the camp when it was Wonder Falls.
Stevie knew the name and sat up.
Allison.
The woman sounded pained.
Allison Abbott gave me your name and said I should contact you. As you knew her, I thought I should let you know.
I know,
Stevie said softly. Susan was silent in acknowledgement.
She asked me to talk to you about what happened here before. I was hesitant, but I want to honor her wishes, if you'd like to speak to me.
Definitely, Stevie said. Yes, could I come to town in the morning?
Fine. Come by any time after 8.
After giving Stevie her address, Susan Marks hung up. Stevie texted this update to David, then slipped into a deep, unbroken sleep.
So who is it we're going to see?
David asked as they pulled out of the camp the next morning. David had come in the old gray Nissan to take Stevie into town, thus sparing her from the treacherous and sweaty bike ride. Stevie had made a show of going over to the art pavilion, but left as soon as Nicole had done the morning rounds. The day was almost unbearably humid. The air conditioning in the car didn't work, so they had the windows open. The morning was bright, but the sun shone through a haze of cloud. Some kind of wild summer weather was afoot. The 12 hours of sleep Stevie had gotten seemed to have revived her. Her body had decided to shut down completely and reboot, and now she was alert, maybe even a little hyper. Sometimes anxiety did that. It could slow you down or speed you up. Susan Marks, she said. She was the head of the camp in 1978.
What am I supposed to be doing during this interrogation? When do I get to pound my fist on the desk? Or am I the one who offers the coffee? You tell me who I'm supposed to be.
I'm not interrogating anyone, she said. It was kind of weird being in a car with David. No one had a car at Ellingham. They had been in all kinds of places and spaces together there. They'd lived in a small dorm house together, cozy little Minerva with its fireplace and old sofas. They'd been in each other's rooms, eaten meals together, seen each other from dawn to dusk. They'd occupied closets together, slept in a ballroom, and crept side by side through tunnels and hidden spaces underground. So a car should not have been a big deal. And yet, she found herself staring at his profile as he drove, one hand on the wheel, the other casually dangling partway out the window. The air knocked his wavy hair back from his forehead. He'd gotten a bit of a tan on the road, an uneven one. Here was the thing about romantic feelings. The sensation was incredible, like a warm flood through every highway and byway of her body. Every good chemical she could produce turned up like some kind of bountiful harvest. But the feelings and the chemicals blocked out everything else. They dulled logic and sense and focus. They made everything else seem kind of irrelevant, and time started to move jerkily,
too fast, then too slow. And they came on with no advance warning, like now, watching him drive. Everything went loose, and all the orderly thoughts in her brain were now just a bag of parts. She wanted to lean over, to kiss him on the soft hollow of his cheek, to pull over and forget going to see Susan. Susan could wait. They could go into the woods.
"You're staring at me,"
he said, not turning his gaze.
"Are you about to bite my face or something?"
"Yes," she said.
"Thought so."
She took a long gulp of thick air and told herself to get it together. David was smiling a knowing smile, like he knew precisely what was going on in her head. They drove past Liberty High with its giant blue billboard.
"They should get a bigger sign," David said. "That one is too subtle."
"I can barely see it," Stevie said.
"Small towns really love their high schools. They seem to scream about them. Why do you think that is?"
"People love to scream."
"That's probably it,"
he said, turning to her with a wolfish grin.
"I know I do."
Focus, she told herself. They were almost there. Susan Marks lived in the center of town, on one of the side streets off the main road. They parked by the library and the green. Barlow Corners was quiet, but not completely still. There were a few people going in and out of the shops. There were people in the Sunshine Bakery with coffee. Stevie followed the map on her phone, which guided them through the painfully quaint lanes that trailed back behind the main drag. The roads here were one lane only, with tidy little Victorian houses groaning under the weight of flower baskets, decorative flags, and wicker porch furniture. Susan's was the last one on this particular lane. She had fewer flags, but many more flowers and shrubs. A woman with sharply cut gray hair was on her knees in a flower bed in front of the house. As Stevie and David turned down her path, she rose and dusted off her knees. Susan Marks was in her mid-70s, and despite a little stiffness as she stood, she had the look of someone who did an hour of yoga a day to warm up for the second hour of yoga she did each day.
"Stevie," she said.
She had the firm, commanding tone of someone who was used to doing roll call.
"And you are?"
"Her assistant," David said. "The one that asks the stupid questions."
"Watson, huh?"
"That's me,"
David replied, smiling.
"It's going to be a hot one today, so I wanted to finish up some of this weeding early. Come on in."
She marched inside, and Stevie and David followed. The inside of the house was almost as plant-heavy as the outside, with ferns and greenery of all sorts in dozens of pots. Two orange cats sat on a perch in a sunny window, lazily entwined around each other. There was a framed collage of photos of Susan and another woman. Stevie paused a moment to look at them.
"My wife," Susan said, noting where Stevie was looking. "Magda. She passed away 8 years ago."
"Oh, it's all right," Susan said. "I didn't say it to make you feel bad. She was the nurse at the camp. That's where we met. There are good memories of the camp, too. She was also an artist. All of these are hers."
Susan indicated the shelves and surfaces full of pottery. Stevie didn't know much about whether pottery was good or bad, but these seemed nice enough to her, and the colors were vibrant. They were led to the kitchen, which was decorated in a surprising pink color. Pink everything. Walls, mixer, towels, floor mats.
"Magda liked a pink kitchen," Susan explained.
"Sit down."
They did as they were told, and Susan put mugs of coffee in front of them.
"I'm sorry about Allison," Stevie said.
"So am I," Susan replied.
"It's a damn shame, horrific. So many terrible things have happened here."
She had been through so much and did so well. "I used to stop at the same spot on my morning runs. A lot of people do. It's got the best view. It's a bad place to fall from."
"She seemed really careful to me," Stevie said.
"Yes."
Susan's gaze drifted a bit.
"She was. Very careful. Not like her to make a mistake like that. People do, of course. Her head must have been somewhere else."
Susan sighed deeply and seemed to collect herself somewhere in the bottom of her coffee cup.
So, she said, why is it you, or that person at the event the other night, think you can solve this case when no one else has?
I don't know if I can, Stevie said. It's more that we're trying to tell the story.
People know the story, Susan replied.
People have been coming here for years, making their shows, writing their books, making money off a tragedy. How are you different?
She's pretty good, David said, nodding at Stevie. Never count her out. She succeeds where others fail, and she's not about money.
Stevie felt herself flush. This conversation had gotten off to a very weird start and was perhaps slipping out of her control. Susan regarded David with interest.
And does she pay you to say that?
She joked dryly.
Me? Oh, yeah, I'm really cheap.
Susan smirked and nodded.
I looked you up, she said to Stevie.
And I know you were okay with Allison, so I suppose there's no harm in going over things again. Where do you want me to start?
Susan Marks was all business, so Stevie would be the same. She confirmed that it was all right to record, which got a terse nod, but a slightly disapproving look.
I guess. She reminded herself to stop saying things like that. She had to sound more like she knew what she was doing. How did you end up at Camp Wonderfalls?
Back in the 70s, I was the head of health and physical education at Liberty High, Susan said.
I taught during the school year, and then there was an opening to run the camp in the summer, and I took it. It suited me. I like to keep busy, and the camp had so many sports and activities to manage. That summer was my fifth one in the job.
So you knew all the... everyone involved well?
Oh, I knew them all, Susan replied. Todd, Diane, Eric, Sabrina. They were all my students, all grew up in town. This town is a bit like a family, but even families.
She let that statement hang for a moment.
You didn't like all of them, Stevie said, trying to read Susan's expression.
No, I didn't like all of them.
I never like to say kids are rotten, but...
Todd Cooper, he was a rotten kid. Charming, polite to your face always. But he was the son of the mayor, who was himself, pardon my French, a real son of a bitch.
Do you think Todd had anything to do with Michael Penhale's death? Stevie asked.
Oh, I absolutely think so, she said, her voice getting louder and her expression more animated.
I don't think anyone doubts that.
He was guilty as sin, and everyone knew it. That was the shame of our town. It was a disgrace, and that no good sheriff we had did nothing, just like he did nothing when the murders happened. Then there was Diane McClure. You know, I liked Diane. She was a good kid, deep down. Her parents owned the Dairy Duchess, the ice cream place across the way. But she was a hard nut, tough, good athlete. I tried more than once to get her to join the track team, but she never would. I think Diane liked a good time and bad boys. Todd was a bad boy. I was unhappy to see those two together, but it wasn't a surprise.
What about Sabrina? Stevie said. No one seems to understand why she was there.
Sabrina was everything people say she was. She was bright as hell, hardworking. Nice kid, really nice kid. She would have left town, done something special with her life. Her parents put a lot of pressure on her to be perfect, and that concerned me sometimes. She was hard on herself. I think she was probably trying to cut loose a little that summer after graduation. She was starting to hang around with Eric Wilde. She trailed off.
Eric Wilde, she said, smiling. I knew him since he was a little boy. His father taught at the school, and his mom was the librarian in town. He was smart, funny. He was also mischievous, but not in a malicious way. It didn't exactly surprise me to find out he was the one supplying the pot to the camp. There's less of a stigma about that now. It's legal here. But at the time, it was a bigger deal. When we found him on that path, it was... She sighed deeply and reached down to pet the orange cat,
who had come over and stretched up on his hind legs for a head scratch. Talking about it gets easier with time, but the feeling never goes away completely. Which is good, I suppose. It means it matters. It should matter. I was in charge. I ran that camp. I was responsible for them. No one ever blamed me, which I think was really generous. I don't know where I stand on blaming myself. I ran a tight ship for the time. You have to understand, never in a million years did we think anything like this could happen. Maybe it was a more innocent time. I'm not sure. There's more monitoring now. Kids don't play unsupervised. Everyone has a phone. Back then, even little kids went out to play on their own, sometimes all day. Kids rode their bikes all around town. I was considered a hard ass for doing spot bed checks and having a lot of rules. So people in town were very good to me after it happened. No one thought I'd failed when those kids went out to the woods, because that's what kids did back then. We expected them to a degree. More coffee? Without waiting for a reply, she took the mugs and went to the counter to refill them. The night of the murders was very normal, she went on as she put the mugs into her coffee machine. It was a few days after the 4th of July. Dinner was served between 5 and 6, and then from 6 to 8, the kids were allowed to play outside, with the counselors supervising them. At 8, everyone returned to their bunks for